Hello, everybody. Well, it's time for Now for Every Season. Now for Every Season, there's a thing, something's going to happen.
What's that all about?
I told you I'd only just woken up.
Everything must change.
Now everything changes. Yeah, so, hello, everybody. Shut up, let's get on with this. We'll go back to bed. Okay, everybody. Welcome to Now Everything Changes.
Hold on, my sister listens to this and she calls us the three grumpy old men.
Well, all of that bit of the going goes at the beginning, but unless you put it up immediately because you can't, you don't have the patience to wait. I mean, I had to edit out all this nonsense at the beginning.
I keep it all in.
Yeah, well, that's not very good, is it?
Perhaps we should just explain to the listeners that we are recording this at just after 7 p.m. on a Thursday evening when us old men should be in bed. Normally we record at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. And well, David Shepherd only woke up 4 to 30.
Yeah, I said
20 minutes ago.
I said to Steve about 4, 5 o'clock today, I just was absolutely shattered and hadn't done anything all day and had to go for a sleep and I woke up about 15 minutes ago. So, yeah, I'm not really...
You'll be back to your horlicks soon, David.
You think? I want some tea. I want to go and cook some tea in a minute.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Can we do this quickly?
Yeah, let's do it quickly.
So, now, welcome, everybody, to Now Everything Changes with Steve Maltz, David Jones, and myself, David Shepherd. And today we're going to get very competitive because we're going to be looking at something that matters to all three of us quite a lot, actually, which is sport. So I'm going to kick things off by asking Steve, come on, tell us a little bit about how sport is important to you.
Well, this is absolutely weird because I grew up as an absolute 100% nerd in my early years.
Still are.
Bunsen burners and stamp collection. that's a little bit of my exciting life. I didn't discover sport until my dad was very much into sport of all different kinds, and he actually got me into tennis quite early. So I was doing tennis on Sunday mornings. But in terms of sports to watch, at that time growing up as a teenager, it was probably tennis because it was the golden years of Borg and McEnroe, etc., and athletics, which was coming into the golden years. Everything else came afterwards, and I'll leave that for a bit later, because I don't want to hog this this first section. David Jones.
I was the complete opposite, Steve. So I was so poor in school, which might surprise people who know me. Career-wise, I went into education, did a degree in theology, and then became a teacher. But I was only interested in two things at school, chasing balls and chasing girls. and I was better at the former than the latter. So I was really good at sport, and three in particular, which again we can talk about in a bit more detail later. But football and tennis again, Steve, and athletics, and the athletics in particular, which as I say, I'll come on to.
And it leads us on to the other David.
Oh well. I guess, you know, I mean, I don't think I was ever particularly sporty in anything. I can remember when I was playing, I had to play rugby union when I was at school because I lived in Rugby. And the school I went to was called Lawrence Sheriff Grammar School. And it was originally known as the Lower School. It was founded by some grocer of Elizabeth I called Lawrence Sheriff. And it was originally set up as something to help the boys of the town as a result of rugby school also being in the town. Rugby school, big private school for very wealthy people. It's still there now. And so there was a kind of compulsory thing that we were going to play rugby union, because rugby started at rugby school when William Webb Ellis picked up the ball when playing a game of football and ran with it, or so the story goes, whether it's true or not. But I do remember spraining my ankle and being carried off the field when I was playing rugby union. And I think thereafter, I tried to avoid sport as much as I possibly could. And library duties was probably the way that were I managed to avoid sport as much as possible.
Yeah, it's funny. My school years was, I mean, you and I are very much peas in the pot. I went to a minor public school. Our PE teacher was an absolute sadist. And the worst thing you can do as a school kid is to be singled out for something early on in your school life. So what happens on the first PE lesson I had, my parents forgot to pack my PE gear. So I turned up to the first lesson without any PE gear. And from that point on, he picked on me throughout the next 3 years.
Wow.
And you know, I suppose it made a man of me. I think it forced me into being more athletic than I had natural ability. We did things like trampolining and rugby was the big, and hockey. And my biggest achievement is I got into the third team for hockey. That was it. Third, not the first or the second, but the third. I was a left wing, and that's the limit of my sporting prowess, probably right up to now, I think. So I'm sure David Jones has got cups and medals and all sorts of things for his achievements. So what have you won in your life, Mr. Jones?
Mainly it's the athletics, Steve. So yeah, I was a very good cross-country runner. On the track, it was always the longer distances, because I had great stamina, so 1,500 metres, 5,000 metres, 10,000 metres. And when
do you think we should probably finish this now, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, yes, you know. Yeah, we don't have the endurance.
I mean, I just kind of feel that our light is dimming.
I think
getting bigger and bigger and brighter and brighter.
Well, no, give me his moment of glory.
Yeah, I'll have my moment in the sun then. So things changed really when I was, when I first became a Christian, because it was shortly after that incredible movie, which I still love to this day, Chariots of Fire, was released. And that had a profound effect on me for all kinds of different reasons, obviously because of the whole message of the story. Just fantastic. If anybody's not seen it, and there may be people who haven't, just go and have a look, because it's this incredible story of two different athletes, Eric Liddell, played by Ian Charlson, and Harold Abrahams. I can't remember the name of the actor who played Harold Abrahams, who was a Jewish athlete.
Ben somebody or other, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we can probably look it up, Ben something.
Remembered forever as Ben something.
Ben something, that's right. That's right. So this morning, I showed my little boy who's six, the two different races from the movie. So I showed him the Harold Abrahams one and the Eric Liddell one, and just explained a little bit of the background about it. But there's a phenomenal scene as Eric Liddell's about to race. So for those who don't know, Eric Liddell was down to do the 100 metres and the 200 metres, but both of those events were scuppered for him because the quarterfinal and semifinal were going to be run on a Sunday. Mm. And as a Christian, he didn't believe you should be running on Sunday. So he did the 400 metres instead, an event that he hadn't really trained for. And just before the race, I don't know how true this is or whether this was just for dramatic effect, but a guy called Jackson Schultz, who was a friend of one of the American athletes, came up to Eric Liddell and handed him a piece of paper. I can't remember, it might be from the Book of Samuel, Stephen, or whether you know this for sure. And it actually said, "He who honours me, I will honour."
Okay.
And then Liddell starts racing. He wins the race. And he also says this phrase, which he says over and over again to his sister, because his sister was a bit nonplussed about him entering for the Olympics, because she felt he should be going off to be a missionary.
Which, of course, he did, didn't he?
Which, of course, he did, yeah.
He did end up as a missionary in China, I think.
Yeah, he actually ended up dying in a Japanese internment camp.
Really?
Wow. In 1945.
Yeah.
But yeah, so his sister was very much against him competing. She thought that was certainly secondary to his missionary exploits. But he actually said to her, you know, "I believe that, you know, God made me, but I also believe that God made me fast."
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. By the way, it's Ben Cross.
Ben Cross. You've just looked it up, Steve.
No, it just came to my mind.
It just came to my mind.
can we stay on athletics for a bit?
Oh, yeah, go on then.
Oh, go. Because it was the era, I think, when the 70s hit the 80s, suddenly we had a really golden age of athletic middle distance, which I'm sure David Jones got into. And I remember, David, you saying that you've always been a bit of a maverick. That's David Jones's. And I'd say all my sporting heroes were always mavericks and still are. And when you look at that era, we had Coe and Ovid, who between them must have broken the world record for, was it the 800, 1500 metres, about 8 or 9 times. It was, for me, I can see you, maybe you're a Coe person, but I'm very much an Ovid person. He was the outsider. He was the rebel. He was the maverick. And I absolutely love it. He was my first sporting hero. Steve Ovett. So who are you? Which one were you, David?
I was Sebastian Coe.
Oh, I thought so.
Which is, it's a strange one, really, because they came from very different backgrounds. Mm. Ovett was a very working class lad.
Yeah.
Sebastian Coe, you know, public school, later went on into politics. I'm not making this up. I was actually broken hearted when at the Moscow Olympics in 1980, Ovett beat Coe in the 800 metres, and the 800 metres was Sebastian Coe's event. So he got the silver medal, Ovett got the gold, and then it was the 1500 metres.
It swapped over remarkably because
Steve Ovett was better at the 1500 metres, and he ended up getting the bronze medal, Steve Ovett, and Coe got the gold medal. And I was jumping up and down in my living room. I can still remember it. And he wrote a book, Sebastian Coe, called Running for Fitness, which I literally read religiously, and that helped me to get a place in the Liverpool Harriers.
Oh, wow.
For middle and long distance running. So everything he said in there, all the training devices he had, which I could bore you with, but I won't, really helped me to become a really good athlete.
Wow. What about Steve Cram, who came a bit later?
Yeah, I love Steve Cram as well. Yeah. I mean, if you go back, you had Brendan Foster, who then was commentating on all the...
Yeah, I remember him.
Really great guy. I really liked him. But, and obviously he knew Steve Cram really well as well, because we're from the same area of the country in the Northeast.
But probably my second hero was Daley Thompson. Maverick. He did not care, did he? But he was so far above everyone else. And in terms of being competitive, that was a big thing about him, because, you know, he had this rival from Germany, didn't he? And he used to regularly beat him in all the Olympics. And he was so graceless about it. Shove his face in the dirt, didn't he? He was mocking him. He hadn't even had a T-shirt on, you know, to actually mock his... I thought, well, this is great. This is like really showing that you have got something special. Because he's still around, and he's... I think he nurtures young athletes now. He's, you know, maybe he's softened a bit. But he was certainly an anti-establishment figure. And I think, for me, all the sports people who fit that profile are the best. And I was wondering, David Shepherd, whether you have any cricket heroes that are the mavericks, or do you go with the mainstream?
I'm not sure if you would call them mavericks. Well, I suppose in a sense, yeah, because there was one character who, when I was growing up, I absolutely loved, and he was always at odds with everybody, and that was somebody who I call Sir Geoffrey Boycott.
Yeah,
he's not a sir, but I love Geoffrey. I loved his whole approach to everything. You know, I mean, he once spent, I think it was almost a day and a half, scoring about 5 runs. but he had a view about everything which often was at odds with the general view that everybody else had.
Mm.
And I think he rubbed people up the wrong way all the time. Yeah. I can remember once hearing a story about him being at a presentation, which was an evening thing, and David Lloyd, who, you know, is known as, I can't remember what they call him, but he was the...
Bumble.
And he was going to receive some kind of award. Anyway, I think Geoffrey was providing or was going to give the award. And when he came up, he kind of said something like, right, well, okay, you know, I'm going to give this award to David Lloyd. I don't really know why I'm doing it, because he's never done anything in cricket. And it was that kind of... I those are not exactly what's happened, but that's what I remember. It was along those lines. And as he got older, I think he mellowed a lot, but he always had insight to the game, which just was invaluable. And he upset practically everybody.
Is he still around? The whole of Yorkshire.
Yeah, he lives in South Africa, actually. I think he's well into his 80s now, if not his 90s. And he retired from doing Test Match Special a few years back. But loved Jeffrey. But I just going to go on to something else, really, which is like favourite moments. You mentioned a few, but my favourite moment all time in sport was when we were on holiday near Bournemouth, and I'd gone to Christchurch for the day. This was a Thursday, August the 6th, 2015. And we found this little tea room, really, which was just at the end of, it's a river that goes out at Christchurch. And there's a little bridge, and just below the bridge, it was this garden area, and there's a lovely little tea room. So we thought we'd go there for the morning. And we arrived there about, I don't know, just about 11 o'clock. And being mad cricket fans, we had the cricket on the radio. And I went out to get the ticket to put, you know, to pay for the car parking. And as I walked back, Debbie shouted out, "Stuart Broad's taken a wicket." And I went, "What? The match has only just started. This was the third ball of the day and he'd taken a wicket." And we saw it. Put the ticket on the car, we got out the car, we started walking. And it was like a 5-10 minute walk to where the team room was. And we'd gone no more than about 20 yards when we could hear on the radio. We're walking along, you know how you used to do? We had the radio. I always had it on my shoulder. Listening to the cricket. And suddenly, within a few yards, it was, "He's taken another one." And this happened all the way to the tea room. And I think he'd lost, I don't know, about 3 or 4 wickets by then. And we sat at the tea room drinking our coffee and tea. And wicket after wicket fell. And I've got some of the things here which it says about it. It was one of the most amazing days of cricket, because in the end, Broad took 8 for 15.
So what was it? Test match? Was it Australia?
Test match against Australia. Oh, it's one of the most remarkable bowling performances ever. Mm. And, you know, I didn't actually see it, but I heard it, and it was just as exciting. And I've got something which talks about it here. It says, "For Australia, they've been routed against all predictions. No one anticipated not just this scoreline, but the results we've seen too. From ball one in this test, England have totally dominated the match. Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the waves," sings the crowd, as England parade around the ground. Jimmy Anderson among them too. He's hoping to be fit for the celebration of the Oval in 2 weeks' time. "But England have done the business here without their leading wicket taker in tests. 8 for Stuart Broad in the first innings, 6 for Ben Stokes in the second. Both test bests. Mark Wood played his part too and brings out his imaginary horse impression in front of the Radcliffe Road stand." Well, you know, it went... We were due to go and watch the match. We got tickets on the Saturday, and this was all happening on the Thursday. And on the Friday, we watched in unbelief as England scored a massive 391, I think it was. And then they got Australia out for 270 or so. And it ended up with England needing just a few runs on the Saturday morning. And we turned up. And it was amazing because the atmosphere in the ground was phenomenal. I kind of thought that nobody would turn up. I thought there would be nobody there, but it was packed. And I can't remember how many overs that it took to win, but it was probably about, I don't know, 4 or 5 overs and the match was over. The fans went absolutely mad. And to be honest, England spent about an hour and a half. The players spent about an hour and a half walking around the ground, talking to people at the boundary, you know, standing there and allowing people to take selfies with them. Phenomenal atmosphere. And then we then wandered around the ground and we saw the Australian team come out and get into their team bus. And I have never seen such a dejected group of people in my life. They actually looked grey. One of the best days of sport I've ever known.
There's no nerd like a cricket nerd, is there?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I can go on for a bit longer.
I know you could. I was timing you. That was about 8 minutes.
Well, it was phenomenal. It was, and you know, it was so exciting, and the atmosphere at the ground, even though we only had about half an hour of cricket, was great. Wouldn't have missed it for anything.
Well, I'll tell you my favourite sporting moment, because I actually saw it, I say live on the TV, but it's been seen millions of times on YouTube, been voted as the best moment in sporting history.
Well, so, you know,
and it happened on the athletics field. And David will know if I say the words, Derek Redmond.
Oh, Derek Redmond.
That race when he pulled up, I think he was winning, wasn't he? And he pulled up his leg, he got cramp or pulled something with his leg, and his dad comes out of the crowd and carries him the rest of the way. My goodness. I mean, that is just, you know, you can't script things like that. You know, and it had, that has won awards, you know, and I'm sure Derek Redmond has done very well since then just by talking about it. And I'm sure his dad, you know, probably went to his grave as a happy man just for that one moment. But sport can bring up moments like that. It's not just about winning. It's also about taking part in a way that sort of raises you up, you know, in your spirit, and makes you, you know, because that was very much a sort of a human spirit thing. But
or raises your hackles. I mean, I always remember that. I always remember that race with Sola Budd and the American. And I can't remember what her name
Mary
was. Zola Budd ran without
Decker.
Any
Decker.
Mary Decker.
Yeah. Decker. She. Sola Budd ran without any shoes, didn't she?
Yeah.
And there was this accusation by Decker that Sola Budd had tripped her up or something.
Yeah, she drop-kicked her, I think.
And it obviously had happened, but this woman, American woman, spent the next 20 years moaning about it.
Yeah.
But that was quite incredible. I mean, I remember, you know, it was...
Well, in that race, the American woman, she was the darling of American sport.
That's right.
And she was expected to win quite... dramatically, and this Zola Budd came from nowhere,
and she just basically fell over, didn't she?
Didn't fit the script.
I'm sorry, but I've got to go back to my broad.
I'm not cricket.
I'm going to tell you, I've got the scorecard for Australia in the first innings here. Listen to this: Rogers caught Cook bowled broad naught. Warner caught Butler bowled wood naught. Smith caught Root bowled broad 6. Marsh caught Bell bowled broad 0. Clark caught Cook bowled broad 10. Voge caught Stokes bowled broad 1. Neville bowled Finn 2. Johnson caught Root bowled broad 13. Stark caught Root bowled broad 1. Hazelwood not out 1.
This is not going to mean anything to about 90%.
Hold on a minute. Hold on. I haven't finished. Lyon caught Stokes bowled broad 9. Extras 14. Total 60. Right. So they basically were out for 46. Right,
Extras was the best.
The top score was extras were top scorer. It's out of my system now. You can talk about anything else. Anything else you talk about, I'm not interested in now.
Right. When our kids were teenage, we used to take them to Crystal Palace for the athletics. That's one advantage of living in London. They used to have sports or special days on Friday nights. And we used to go Friday nights. And one of them, do you remember Steve Backley? Javelin thrower?
Javelin thrower.
Well, we were there when he did a world record.
Wow.
Right in front of us. And we actually thought, you know, it actually happened. To actually be there live, not on TV, for a world record is something that is so rare. You just want to savour it and remember it. Because in those days, we didn't have mobile phones or video.
No, that's right.
Yeah. You know that saying about if a leaf fell in a forest and nobody was there?
Yeah.
would it have really happened or something like that? I can't remember what it is. Yeah. Is that the saying?
Well, that really happened.
Yeah. But no, what I'm thinking about is without the crowd, that's most of these amazing events with and happenings with sports people, it's almost like they would never have been celebrated. It was almost as though they hadn't happened. But having the crowd there and the atmosphere and the people recording it, that's what kind of makes it celebrated.
That's interesting, wasn't it? Because during COVID, there were empty stadiums, but they still played the games.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for Sky or, you know, satellite, no one would have seen them either.
Yeah,
they would have played them and no one would have... Isn't it interesting? So in those situations, if we didn't have cameras there, then those games were just played for the benefit of the players.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The best goal ever could have been scored and no one would have known.
Nobody would have known. Did it really happen?
Did it really happen? Yeah.
It wasn't recorded.
Yeah.
It would be one of those, you know, conspiracy theories. It didn't. Yeah. It never really happened.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't really land on the moon.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you where my sporting love of football and rugby started. Football, I just hated. My dad was an Arsenal supporter, so that explains something. Took me once to see Charlie George and that lot in the 70s, and I never went back. When I went to university, it was 1974, and it was the World Cup, and it was the Dutch team. And I never looked back. That team still lives in my memory.
Is that with Cruyff?
Yeah, the Cruyff team, the total football. I remember watching it with everyone else in university, and it was the first time I ever watched football, and I thought, if this is what football is, and when you think, you know, from that team, what Cruyff did, you know, he actually brought us to the situation with Guardiola at Man City. The way of playing all started back in 1974 with Cruyff. Yeah. So he was my footballing hero. And they lose because they were so arrogant in the final.
Yeah.
They thought they could walk it. And the Germans being Germans, they never give up. So that was sort of a slight negative. But just to move on very quickly, my rugby, interesting rugby, I just feel so privileged that I was exposed to the Welsh rugby of the 70s. Because absolutely, and they're all dying off now. You know, Barry John, JPR Williams, JJ Williams, there's Phil Bennett. The only one still alive is Gareth Edwards. But they were absolutely phenomenal.
They were.
I still watch videos of the way that they played. They were amateurs. They used to, you know, at halftime, they were sort of swigging their beer and the fags. Yeah, no special diets, you know, parties the night before. Yeah, they played like absolute angels.
Yeah,
you know, and or demons, you know, in some cases, and that really, you know, I just feel really privileged to be able to talk about, you know, that I was in the era of the 1974 football team, the Dutch team, and the Welsh team of the 70s for rugby.
Yeah, yeah. You know. I mean, David might have missed this because he's a bit younger than us, but you and I, Steve, also remember 1966.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, again, that feels like a privilege nowadays to be able to say to somebody, I actually watched England win the World Cup at Wembley. And I can more or less remember the whole of the team still now.
There's only one left.
Jeff Hurst, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's just the only one still alive.
Yeah.
But I that was remarkable. And I remember watching it on little black and white television and being so excited, even though I've watched it
recently. They colorized it and they put it on TV a few years ago. And it was a good game.
Well, they actually filmed it as opposed to the television version. They had a film version of the match, which was in color.
Yeah.
And that was, it was good. Yeah. Before your time, David.
Yeah, I was two. So
David, what went wrong in your life that made you support Everton?
My dad, and actually going back to 1960, that's an interesting one because in 1966, the FA Cup final that year, although I don't remember it obviously, was between West Brom and Everton. And my eldest brother, Michael, who is 12 years older than me, so he does remember it, and remembers watching it with my dad. And we were 2-0 down at half time, and my brother ran out the room crying.
Oh.
And Everton came back and won it 3-2. Mm. So that was extraordinary. I mean, for me, there's so many different highlights. Mm. So 1977, I think, I was a member of the St. John's Ambulance. So I would have been 13. And I was sat behind the goal, the opposite end of the Gladys Street at Goodison Park when Everton played Liverpool. And invariably, we always lost to Liverpool, and that's continued right up to this day.
Hooray!
But on that particular day, a midfield genius called Andy King hit the ball from 30 yards out. I was behind the goal, and it flew into the net past Ray Clements. And I jumped up, which you're not meant to do when you're in the St. John's Ambulance, but I couldn't help myself. So that's definitely one of my abiding memories. I've got others which are a bit dodgy, really. A bit like you, David, I do enjoy my cricket. And I was a member for a long time of Lancashire Cricket Club. And that often gave me not just priority tickets to see Lancashire play, but priority tickets for the Test match as well.
Wow.
And there was one particular occasion when England were playing Pakistan at Old Trafford. And so I went along to that, and I was in the members' enclosure. And very, very, a brilliant experience. I'm going to really get myself in trouble for what I'm about to say. But it was made all the more enjoyable by the fact that I was actually sat in with the Pakistani players' wives. So that was before I was married to Joe, I should hasten to add. But that was very nice. So we got chatting to most of them, which was very lovely. But the thing that I would like to go back to in terms of highlights is, again, with this Maverick thing, is the tennis, Steve.
Mm.
And while everybody else enjoyed Borg, although I thought it was a bit robotic.
Yeah.
Then everybody liked McEnroe because he there was never a dull moment.
Yep.
But my hero tennis-wise was always Jimmy Connors.
Me too. I was going to say exactly the same.
Yeah, just right. A street fighter, you know, didn't have any lessons, you know, taught himself to play the game, which I did as well. And I just absolutely adored him.
Do you remember when he played at Wimbledon, was it Ken Rosewall? And it was the new against the old.
That's right.
And he had no mercy, did he?
No, absolutely.
Put him to the sword. You know,
I thought he was terrific.
Yeah. He had this double-handed backhand, wasn't it? Really sashed the ball. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. But I think it might be interesting to just think about for us as believers, you know, is it healthy to be so competitive? Because I always was on the track. I mean, I just couldn't help it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because obviously since the 70s and because of society has gone into this more touchy-feely sort of phase, kids are encouraged just to take part and not necessarily to win. And everyone is to be celebrated. And you can see where that's coming from, and you can sort of see it. You know, if you are a nerd like me and David, then that was probably quite comforting. But on the other hand, there's part of the human spirit that says that we've got to strive. And I mean, it's biblical, isn't it? In Timothy, it's about, you know, run the race and get to the end and persevere, don't give up. And I suppose it's when it's taken to an extreme where you're doing it not necessarily to win, but to make sure that someone else doesn't win. You know, just like Jimmy Connors, the way that he did Ken Rosewall, looking back, wasn't probably the nicest thing that he could have done. But on the other hand, winning is winning. Let's face it, if it wasn't for that, there wouldn't be sport. Sport is really about winning, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's about winning, and it's about the drama as well.
Yeah, but and sometimes there's moments of poignancy. I remember there was a race not so long ago. I think it was a triathlon where a guy collapsed just feet or yards away from the finishing line.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And the guy who came up behind him stopped and got his arm, helped him.
It was his brother.
And helped him over his line.
It was his brother.
Well, yeah, no, but there's been two instances. One was with the brothers, and there was another one where the similar kind of thing happened. Yeah. And I find that that's always really moving, isn't it? It's very poignant when somebody does that, and they almost sacrifice their own victory in order to help somebody across the line.
Yeah, just to bring in to the team of the year, West Ham. we had a maverick, and you all remember him, Paolo Di Canio.
Oh my word!
Now, okay, he was a maverick, and he did push over a referee, got into lots of trouble. But if you speak to a West Ham supporter, he will be the one. Certainly in my generation and the younger generation, he will be above Bobby Moore, Jeff Hurst, to be Di Canio, absolute hero. And the thing about Di Canio, he had this sense of fair play, even though he became a fascist in later years. But there was a game, you probably remember it, because they do play it a lot, when he had the ball in the penalty area, and then the goalkeeper fell over. And he could have scored quite easily. And he stopped and he picked the ball up. He stopped the game. He actually stopped the game when he could have actually scored because a sense of fair play. And I think he's won lots of plaudits for that since. And I suppose, fair play is a part of it, isn't it? Because you remember these things.
You do remember the lack of fair play as well, don't you? I mean, there's in the rugby union the other day. Do you remember seeing I think it was George Ford taking a penalty?
Oh yeah,
Or was it a conversion? I can't remember. But he stood for quite a long time and then moved slightly to the left.
Yeah.
And who were they playing? I can't remember. But the opposing team started to run towards him and kick the ball away before he had a chance to take the conversion.
It was Wales, wasn't it? Wales.
And I think it was actually, because I can remember the
red twitch. He did a slight twitch.
Slight twitch to the left.
Yeah.
And apparently it was within the rules, but and I also remember there's something that happened, I can't remember, so long ago in the cricket where a bowler...
Cricket, not again.
Yeah, bowler came into bowl and the batsman was backing up a little bit too much and he was out of his crease at the umpire's end, the bowler's end, and the bowler just knocked the bails off and he was out. And there was a real controversy about it.
Because, I thought that was outrageous, actually.
It was outrageous. It was absolutely outrageous. And I was so across about it.
Oh, I'm sure Colonel Blimp was really irate about that. So some things were against the spirit of the game.
Well, it felt like it was against the spirit of the game. It was legal. The guy was definitely out. But, I mean, he could have just warned him, couldn't he, first?
Mm. Yeah. Going back to Mavericks.
We're back to Mavericks now.
I've got a list of Mavericks. I just wonder what particularly David Jones would actually identify with any of these. Matt Letizia. What a fantastic player.
Southampton,
but never played for England.
I never understood that. He was a genius.
Yeah, absolutely. Of his generation, he was a one-off.
Conspiracy theorist now, but a genius as a footballer.
Yeah. But obviously now he's into lots of controversies in other ways. But he never played, I think maybe played once for England, but never left Southampton, which is interesting. Going back a generation... me and my dad used to love player for QPR, Stan Bowles. Remember him?
Stan Bowles.
Oh, I remember Stan Bowles.
Yeah.
He ended played up for Wolverhampton, wasn't he?
No, QPR.
QPR?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He ended up as a gambling addict and had to leave the game early.
Yeah, a bit like Paul Mercer.
Duncan McKenzie.
Oh, you used to love Duncan McKenzie, Steve.
Yeah.
I think that was Leeds, something.
Yeah, so he played for Leeds and Everton, and it's interesting that because although I grew up supporting Everton, I had a great affinity for that Leeds team of the 1970s. You know, I could probably name the whole team. You know,
the Don Revie team,
yeah, and they were naughty at times with Norman Hunt and Billy Bremner, but they were Alan Clark and Peter Lorimer. I thought
they weren't naughty. David, they were thugs.
Norman bites your legs.
Norman bites your legs, Hunter. Yeah, that's right.
Thugs, I remember.
That was all under Don Revie, wasn't it? Who caused all those problems. I think the way he managed them.
Yeah. I must admit, though, I had an interest in that team as well, because I probably could remember a lot of their names as well, because I think they just won everything, similar to the Arsenal team about the same time, and a lot of Liverpool teams. Well, of course, we're not mentioned. I meant to mention Liverpool. Though, David up top there, are you a Liverpool supporter?
Yeah.
Or are you quite? So we've got Liverpool and Everton here, have we?
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunate. Yeah, well, you know.
Keeping it quiet. Never mind. Let's go.
Don't rain on my parade, David Shepherd.
Well, okay, yeah, I think probably we ought to compromise and go for Tranmere Rovers.
Well, maybe not.
No.
So what about those things that are, like in the Olympics and in other ways, are called sports, like darts and snooker? Are they sports?
No.
I mean, you don't have to train physically for them, but they are called sports, aren't they?
There's skill involved, isn't there? But yes. Where did you draw the line? It's interesting. We started off talking about Eric Liddell, and he won the gold medal in the 400 metres at the Paris Olympics in 1924. And I noticed when I was thinking about the podcast this week that this year's Olympics are going to be held in Paris as well. And again, you've got some of these ludicrous sports that are going to be included for the first time. So I do find that a bit bizarre. I mean, do you stop at chess, graphs? Where'd you go? Tiddlywinks?
Yeah.
Marbles, yeah.
Marbles, yeah.
Yeah, why not?
So, yeah. There's obviously the skill involved in all those. I see those as games rather than sports.
It seems to me, even if you're 16, the main event really with darts is drinking beer, isn't it?
Yeah. It seems to be, doesn't it?
I mean, any sport where they don't have to have a shower afterwards. It's not really. I can't imagine darts. They just carry on drinking afterwards, don't they? Yeah. And probably snooker as well. I don't know.
You were talking about Mavericks. I mean, I always thought that Man United, Eric Cantona was a real Maverick, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember what the ridiculous thing he came up with when he attacked somebody in the crowd. Yeah. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Karate kick, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it was something along the lines of, wasn't it, when the...
Something to do with seagulls.
Yeah, when the seagulls are following a fisherman's boat or something, they know when the fish is going to be thrown over the side, something like that, wasn't it?
And it was everybody at the press conference went,
Yeah.
What? What is he talking about?
Yeah, they should have read some of Steve's books about Greek thinking.
But on the other hand, a phenomenal player.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, I think he's listed in a list of Man United greats as something like number 9.
Yeah,
number four. Just looking at,
and you'd include George Best because you know absolute sublime skill, but again, yes. Maverick as well.
Well, George Best is number 2 in terms of the top 50.
Yeah,
and guess who was number 1?
Bobby Charlton.
Yeah, absolutely, Bobby Charlton, a real gentleman. You couldn't get much more of a contrast between George Best and Bobby Charlton, could you?
Well, you know what? It's interesting that, David, isn't it? Because Don't we need that? I mean, and as Christians, don't we need that as well?
Yeah.
So we need mavericks. Yeah. We need people who are gentlemen, but we need mavericks as well.
Yeah.
We need people who are funny. We need people who are going to lead from the front. We need people who are going to lead us in worship, wherever it might be. You know, that's what Jesus did by choosing 12 different men.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so he had a substitute as well. And of course, Jesus means saviour, so he would have been a good goalkeeper.
Oh, good.
I'm pushing it a bit there, but
he's on a roll here.
you've been thinking about that one all week, haven't you? That was scripted. That was thrown in as something that had been thought through and planned, and we were waiting for the moment when you could throw that in.
There we go. Football game actually involves Manchester United. Strangely enough, my favourite Everton game was against Liverpool, an FA Cup game at Goodison Park, which ended 4-4. When I think Tony Cotty scored the equaliser. Amazing.
Tony Cotty? Game.
Yeah, Tony Cotty. Yeah. One of your former guys, Steve, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think the European Cup final in 1999, when Manchester United won it, in, you know, injury time, basically, after being 1-0 down was absolutely extraordinary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, again, you're just talking about scripting things, David. You couldn't have scripted that.
That was Teddy Sheringham, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the great thing, isn't it, about sport, is sometimes the underdog comes and wins. And you just, I'm always rooting for the underdog. I mean, it's strangely, with rugby union, I have always want, whenever Italy play, even if they're playing England, I want Italy to win because they never win a match. And I want them, you know, I'm rooting for them. Come on, you've got to win.
I think they beat Scotland once, I think. I've never beaten England.
Wasn't there that wonderful, was it 1992? And the war in Yugoslavia had just erupted. Mm. And so Yugoslavia, who'd qualified for European Championship, were banned from playing. And so it went to the team who'd finished highest in their table. And that was Denmark. And they went on to win it. Imagine how sport throws up these...
And of course, Leicester in the Premiership a few years back. Yeah.
Bizarre.
Yeah, you just can't make it up, can you, these things?
No.
Here's a question for you guys. What sports do you think Brits follow most?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I would say you would think football is the number one sport.
Spot on. Apparently, 80% of sports fans follow football to some extent, even if it's like me that, you know, I'm not somebody who attends matches, but I do love watching it on television.
Is fishing considered a sport?
It's actually not in the list of sports that people follow, but about 104,000 people in the UK participate in angling. Which is a surprising number, isn't it?
I mean, it's almost as boring as cricket, isn't it? Just sitting there with nothing happening for ages.
That's another outrageous statement you've just made.
Yeah, just watch it. Watch it, Maltz.
Two against one.
So what else is on that list, David? Then? Can I have a guess at the top?
Yeah, go for it. Okay. Second one.
I am going to say, I don't know about the order, but I am going to say cricket's in there.
It is. It's number three. It's 26%.
I'm going to say...
Which is such a big gap between that and football.
Absolutely.
80% to 26%.
Rugby union?
Rugby's 25%.
Okay, I'm going to say Formula One.
21%. Well, motorsports in general, 21%.
Yeah, okay, I can't think what the next one would be.
Tennis? Well,
tennis was 25%. That was number five. But the surprising one for me was 29% following...
Golf.
Boxing.
Oh, boxing,
okay.
Yeah, golf is down at 16%, followed by 14% for athletics, 13% for American football, which I find unbelievable because I don't even think it's a game, is it?
No,
I just don't understand it.
It's pretend rugby, isn't it?
And all they do is they stop for long times and then they bring new people on and the ball's in the air and they do something for 2 seconds and then everybody gets very excited.
It's just set plays. There's no ebb and flow. I mean, when you watch rugby, a passage of play could go on for like 5-10 minutes. There'll be like 20 phases, 25 phases when the ball's in play all that time and they're running to a standstill. In American football, they kick the ball once, you know, jump a bit and then stop.
Well, Steve, I've got to say about that. So with the American football and the baseball, I've been to live games in the US to watch both and found myself, you know, contemplating my own death. absolutely the, awful it, things. Awful.
The sporting equivalent of jazz.
Yeah,
or,
absolutely.
Or cricket.
That's a great analogy, David, and well remembered. But yeah, absolutely just awful. And one of my biggest regrets is I'm going to sound like such a Tory when I say this, but I really deeply regret not going to a public or private school because. I fell in love with rugby union when I was a teenager and rugby league for that matter as well. And I never played rugby at all.
Right.
Not at all. And I find that I did play cricket and love cricket. But I would have loved to have played rugby. I would have been a fly half, I think, given my slim build. But absolutely loved it.
Well, let me say to you that if you had had my experience of rugby union in a very, very cold January, where the pitch was rock hard and the ice was so brittle it could cut you.
Yeah.
And I can remember playing it, and I think I must have been about 14, 15. I think we mentioned this in a previous podcast, actually, previous podcast. And I've never been so cold in my life. And it was one of those things that said, yeah, I like watching it, but I don't want to play it anymore.
Well, my memory is similar to that, except we tend to play a lot when after it had been raining. So the whole pitch was waterlogged and just mud. And our sadistic gym teacher just made us tackle in the mud. He just loved it.
Yeah.
And, well, I was going to say something else, but I'm going to get into dodgy areas. But I was going to say, because we did have a gym teacher that quite enjoyed watching the boys in the showers.
Oh,
okay. we won't go there.
Okay, yeah.
But, you know, strange days. Don't, you know, being in a public school in the 60s is exactly as dodgy as everyone says it was.
Yeah, it's amazing anybody survived it, really.
Yeah. So anyway,
we would be impoverished, though, wouldn't we, without sport? I think, in many ways, that in terms of entertainment, it's without peer, because the highs and lows of any kind of sport, and the exhilaration that comes from watching something or participating in something which is special.
Yeah, I mean, even like watching 2 years ago now, the Lionesses win the European Championship. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely remarkable.
Yeah.
And you know,
yeah,
just again, the whole drama of it. Mm. And I can't remember the name of the woman who scored the winning goal now. But I mean, you know, she took off her top
Chloe.
Yeah, Chloe, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then she gets booked. I always find bizarre when you know, you've just scored like such an important goal. But it just throws up these incredible stories all the time. Again, going back to the previous European Championships that the men took part in, and Christian Eriksen having a cardiac arrest on the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, to go back to that thing you were saying before, Steve, about Derek Redmond's father, and how everybody, fans and players and officials, all came together, you know, to try and save his life. Just extraordinary stories. I don't think there's, as you said, David, I don't think there's anything that compares with it for drama and for interest.
Here's the thought. If we were in ancient Rome, would we have been going to the amphitheatres to watch the Romans and the gladiators killing the Christians?
Only if Russell Crowe was there.
What do you mean? We'd probably be the Christians being killed.
Yes, we probably would have been thrown to the lions and then slaughtered.
We all need to come up with a really good speech, don't we, to match Maximus Decimus Meridius.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was brilliant, wasn't it?
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I think they're bringing out a second film, aren't they?
Really?
Gladiator 2, but without Russell Crowe, because he's put on about 5 stone.
I hope he's not listening.
Yeah. Well, look, we've had almost an hour on this. I wonder if we could have some conclusions, some summaries from each of you.
Go on, Steve. Start.
Well, to say, go sport. Rah, rah, rah.
Well, I would just go back to the Eric Little quote. You know, I think he honors me, I will honor. I just think that's on a par with Gladiator, isn't it?
Yep, absolutely. Well, look, I'm just going to say thanks ever so much. We've had a great time. We really enjoyed ourselves tonight, haven't we? So it's going to be. Thanks very much for listening to Now Everything Changes with Steve Maltz, David Jones, and myself, David Shepherd. And hopefully we'll catch you next time. But in the meantime, if you've been listening to this, we would love to have your comments, to hear what you think about sport and some of your memories about sporting events that you've been to. But for now, bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, folks. Bye.